James Herring for Plaintiff Appellant, Subto Entertainment Corporation. Subto is a small company that made a product that was very important to the karaoke industry. That product is the Sound Choice brand of karaoke company contracts. Now, in this case, there are two sets of claims that are issued before the court today. One are trademark and service mark infringement claims and related torts to those, as well as a contract claim that runs from Mr. McCullough's breach of prior settlement.
Is the state law counterfeiting claim before us?
It was dismissed by
the dismissed by district court. I don't find very much in your briefing about it. Maybe a footnote.
It's not,
that's great.
Well, the standard is that there's not much in the brief because the standard for whether something is a trademark infringement or not, or a state law counterfeiting claim or not, a trademark counterfeiting claim or not, turns on the same question as claims rise or fall.
Well, there's a different question, I think, that Judge Hurwitz is getting at. Ordinarily, if an argument is not raised separately and clearly in the opening brief to this court, we will not decide it, even if it was discussed ad nauseum in the district court. It's considered a waiver. So I think his question goes to whether, even though it was clearly pleaded and dealt with in the district court, whether your opening brief sufficiently raises a separate state-based counterfeiting statutory claim, because it's somewhat different from a federal claim in its criteria.
What'd you say?
I understand the point. I believe it was briefly raised in our brief.
One more question, because you said the standards are the same. They're not, are they? The one thing I'm pretty certain about is I know Arizona law. I'm not so sure I know copyright trademark law. But under Arizona law, there's a statutory presumption, and you have to show sale or distribution, and that's a little bit different than the federal trademark law, isn't it?
I think there are some differences. I think the thrust of the question is the same, but I think that if this court decides it wasn't appropriately raised on appeal, we don't have an issue with that.
Why don't you then move on to that with my claim? Why don't you talk to us about where is the consumer confusion about the producer of goods requirement that the digital copy has Subto's mark in it? The only difference would appear to be the format in which it's presented. What is the confusion?
Well, the confusion is rooted in the Supreme Court's decision in the Daystar case,
right?
That for purposes of the Lanham Act, the origin of goods, or the origin of services in this case, is not the author of the underlying content. That would be a copyright claim, but rather the creator of the physical goods that are in use. And in this case, Mr. McCullough did not use the original goods that were supplied to him. Copies.
Right, but you authorize copies, right? You allow them to actually use copies. And it seems to me are you really here just about the fact that they didn't get permission to do it? Not that there's confusion, right? But that if they had gotten permission, you wouldn't be arguing confusion. Is that right?
Right, because our quality controls would have come into play.
Put quality aside for a second. Just I'm a consumer of karaoke. The clock
is reset.
Wait a second. I know. It's one of our little tricks. We'll see if we can throw you. We'll put you back on you by the time you're supposed to have it. Okay. I'm a consumer of karaoke, which is to say I go to karaoke bars and sing. I wouldn't be confused about where this program came from. Your name is on it. Your client's name.
My client's name is on it. But I think, first of all, likelihood of confusion is a question of fact, or at best, a cross question.
On summary judgment, when the facts are not disputed, it's undisputed that every consumer saw your client's name on the program
if they cared. I think procedurally, the trademark claims are 12B6, and therefore, the and it was inappropriate for.
Well, there may be other reasons. Okay, but fair enough. But answer that question. If every consumer saw your client's name on the program, how could there be consumer confusion?
Because my client did not make the goods that were in use and did not authorize the services that were being provided. It is true that SunTel allows copying, but there are very specific terms and conditions under which that copying can occur. And those terms and conditions are geared toward maintaining the very high quality standards.
That sounds to me like a copyright claim. That's my view. I understand everything you were saying if this were a copyright claim, but it's a trademark claim.
Well, it is a trademark claim for the reasons that Holder noted. It's an issue of quality control. We have no interest in, at least as far as this case is concerned, in the actual content of what's being played.
I take it you don't have a copyright. You don't really have a copyright.
That's not before the court.
Okay.
The issue here is not the communicated content of that material. It's about the quality of the copying. And there is ample citation in the record in the second amendment complaint to show that we have an issue with quality control. Mr. McCuller has a point that he has discarded somewhere between 60% and 90% of the information in paragraph 26 in the second amendment complaint that's associated with that content.
Is this case distinguishable from the Seventh Circuit case?
It is very much distinguishable, first of all. In the Seventh Circuit case, talking about Robinson, the defendant of the case was a karaoke bar. There were only the goods trademarks that were issued. You could not see them on the services marks. And the way that that karaoke bar actually ran its business, it did not charge anything for its services, its various services. It was just something that was provided.
Well, but put aside the sale or distribution issue, I mean, Rumsey is saying, essentially, what Judge Baldwin was saying, which is that there couldn't be consumer confusion. And that seems to be really exactly the situation in this case, doesn't it?
Well, and here's the problem with that. We're in Rule 12b-6. Consumer confusion, whether there is or not, is a matter of fact. We have not had an opportunity to present that.
Well, would we have to just allege it? It was alleged. I mean, in terms of facts that we recognize to be different, which you allege is that they didn't get permission to show the same thing, which is not an allegation that the actual image that was shown, or the product that was shown, was different, right? There is confusion. Ask my question. Do you allege that the image or the mark that was shown was actually different on the copy than on your CDG
version? The image itself, yes, because of the discarding of information.
No, that's not what Judge Bowen is. He asked whether or not the trademark, the mark that was shown to consumers in this case, was different than your mark.
I think that the image itself is the same. The issue is, however, the quality of the goods to which that mark was attached, the quality of the services to which that mark is attached, is not at the level that SunTel says in terms of its quality control. I don't think you can separate those as a matter of law. Trademarks are designed to be an indicator to consumer quality control. And so the confusion occurs with Mr. McCuller as a free actor without consulting us. It's his own level of quality control without consulting us. He uses our mark in that manner. Consumers are going to be confused because they assume that this is a level of quality that we endorse.
So, go ahead, question.
I'm just going to change topics. Still on this.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to get your thoughts on the motion for substitution of the successor interest. Could you comment briefly on that, please?
I can just say that I see my time's up.
I know, but please answer my question.
Certainly. The motion for substitution is a very basic motion. Essentially, Phoenix Entertainment Partners acquired the assets of SunTel Entertainment Corporation. After this case was filed, even after this appeal was filed, so we're simply seeking to have Phoenix as the successor in interest, be the real party in interest.
Assets or assets and liabilities?
Assets only.
Should we just add them as a party?
As opposed to substitute? I'm sorry, I may have misspoken a bit. There are certain liabilities because there were contracts that were acquired, including the contract in this case, and SunTel had obligations under that contract as well. So Phoenix would step in for them.
But should we add them rather than substitute them?
I think that would be up to the court's discretion.
Of course, but I'm asking their position.
I don't necessarily have a position. I think either one is fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Murray. My name is Lori Murray. I represent the Americans Wire and Sound and PJ Services LLC, and I wish to cover who I'm referring to them collectively as Wired. This court should affirm the district court's rulings in this case for two reasons. First, Sloptone has attempted and then ran around in copyright law to assert its trademark infringement. As Judge Wade of the district court correctly stated, Sloptone's attempts to stuff copyright claims into a trademark container fails. Second, Sloptone's breach of contract claims are precluded as a matter of law by Sloptone's own contract and in their own actions, and they should not be allowed a second bite at the apple.
Well, you guys got the second bite at the apple in the sense because you, your client, breached the settlement agreement. And it, therefore, it gets away without paying what was agreed to be paid under that agreement. So, you know, the equities certainly are not all on one side of this case. And I'm not an expert in Arizona law. That's probably the understatement of the day. But I'm uncertain why that isn't a valid claim.
Well, Your Honor, my client was not the only one that did default on the agreement. Sloptone did as well.
Well, but for purposes, we're at 12B6 here.
Okay.
Did they sue you for breach of the settlement agreement? As I understand it, they could have sought only to revive their trademark claims. The complaint is broad enough, I think, so that it seeks damages to adjustment.
Well, Your Honor, the contract claim was actually not on a 12B6. It was actually on a motion for summary judgment.
Okay, but still, they are seeking damages and injunctive relief, are they not?
Yeah, you're talking about Sloptone, isn't it?
Sloptone.
Yes, Sloptone.
Okay, yes. So why do we find an election at the pleading stage as opposed to normally in choice of remedies? You let somebody sue. Get to the end of the case, and we say, okay, you're either entitled to an injunction or damages. Which do you want? Why isn't Sloptone here in the decision of having to choose early on for its breach of contract claim?
Well, actually, Your Honor, they did choose early on because it was their contract. It was undisputedly integrated, and their contract said that you can either sue for trademark infringement or sue for breach of contract.
Right, but that doesn't answer Judge Hurwitz's question.
What if they sue for both? Is that an election of one rather than the other?
That's actually, I think that is.
Well, why isn't it an election just as valid to say, well, they've elected to sue under the contract. We have to ignore the suit related to trademark. Why isn't that equally a valid way to look at the election?
Because the way that the contract was written was using that word or.
I understand that. That's A or B. And if they do both, you say, well, it has to be B. A is no good anymore, but I don't see why A isn't the one that's the selection and B goes away.
Well, because, Your Honor, that in the contract where it says that it's an option, it can do A or B.
I understand that totally. But
assume that it's option, it says I'd like A or B. It goes to the court and says, I have an option, Judge. I'd like A or B, you choose. Has it waived both?
Well, I don't know that it would waive both.
Which one?
However, if we use A, I don't know the answer to your question.
I don't understand why it isn't equally valid to say they've got a claim here for breach of the settlement agreement. And because of the way it was written, they can't seek these trademark damages. So go forth and litigate on the settlement agreement only. Why isn't that the right answer?
They could have done that, but that's...
I understand that, but what the court said was you have to ignore the settlement contractual claim and go only for trademark. But I don't see why it isn't the opposite.
Well, wouldn't that render the word or as meaningless? So
what do we think? Is it just a choice of remedy? In other words, if they went to the district judge and said, Judge Wade, you're the biggest one guy. We don't know whether we're entitled to trademark relief. But if we're not, we'd like damages. If we are, we'd like trademark relief. We'd like A or B. But we'd like you to decide which one we get. Is that a waiver of both?
I think that could be, but you have to remember that Selectone is the one that wrote this contract. If they wanted those remedies and to make sure that all the remedies were included, they should have written that in their contract. But there is no qualifying language that says add as option A or B. It doesn't say including any other remedies available.
But why decide it when the district court did decide it? Because that's going to be implied in the short question about this being a choice of remedies. Why not let it go all the way to trial and then, as often is the case, you can choose one or the other. Why would it be appropriate to affirm it at this early stage when there is this or option? Just remember, so it could be either a choice. Why now?
Well, this breach of contract claim was not raised until the second amendment complaint.
But it's been
so early.
Okay.
Right. No, I understand. I was trying to. It's in the second amendment complaint. And Selectone had filed their motion for summary judgment and religion in that. On this issue. And when the court looked at it in the light most favorable to the non-movement, they found that as a matter of law, and he interpreted the language and he interpreted the words and the plain meaning of the words to mean that they had A or B.
But the question is the plain meaning of the language A or B at the pleading stage only, or is it that there were, how are we to find that particular issue? It's not that there isn't an or, we all recognize that it says or. The question is, when does the war actually take on a force such that they have to make an election with respect to the remedy?
I believe that happened when the default happened. When the default actually occurred in Selectone's eyes, they made that option.
So in other words, your argument is that the pleading stage had to make a choice. They couldn't plead in the alternative. They couldn't say, I like A or B. They had to actually choose based upon the contract. That's your argument.
Yes.
Okay.
Is it the language of the contract is what we're focused on? Selectone made its option. Why? Accelerate any debt owed to it. Declare them immediately due. Or void the covenant in paragraph 13 of the instituted action for trademark infringement. So my question is, do they void the covenant in some other way other than bringing this suit?
Well, Your Honor, Judge Wake did look at all of the...
Judge Wake is a terrific judge. He's very careful. But I asked you a very specific question. Did they void the covenant in some other way other than by bringing this suit? In other words, did they send a demand letter to your client and say, you're hereby voiding the covenant? Or is the voiding of the covenant solely as a matter of bringing this suit?
I believe it's only as a matter of bringing this suit. Also, it's important to note under this contract as well that when that covenant was voided, that Judge Wade did look to see that all of the trademark that was alleged under there included all of the inclusive dates which would have been before and after the agreement. And it was only until after that the second amended complaint was the breach of contract claim proceeded.
One question, counsel. If we were to consider that the counterfeiting, state counterfeiting claim had probably been raised on appeal, wouldn't they have sufficiently pled it under Arizona law?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because the reason for that is medical and counterfeit is when you're actually making a new product. Now, Selectone would have us believe that by copying it from one medium to another, it's actually creating a new product when it's actually.
But this was on 12b6, wasn't it? Or was it on
trademark? That's right.
The counterfeiting claim. So they pleaded that they made a new product, and they pleaded that there were 26 or more counterfeits out there, and they pleaded sale or distribution. My guess is they can't prove any of that based on what we now know, but isn't that enough at the pleading stage?
Well, no, you're not at this stage either, because even with counterfeiting, when you're making a new product and adding someone's trademark and trade dress to it, that would certainly be counterfeiting, but in this case, didn't either one of those. They copied it from one medium, the CDGs, to another medium. And then the actual technology of the actual copy is being challenged here, not the actions of my client as far as whether a trade dress and trade, you know, if there's any kind of quality is what Mr.
Right, I think Judge Hurwitz's question is about how this pled out about information we would acquire after, right, the complaint was filed, but about it wasn't sufficiently alleged. Right? Because what you're relying upon is important information that is not in the complaint, right?
Right, thank you.
So the question is about the sufficient pleading. Was it sufficiently pled?
In my opinion, it was not. Well, not when it was taken in context with the rest of the pleading.
Okay.
You do.
You use them well.
Okay, well, in conclusion, we are here to ask the court to affirm Judge White's rulings in on both the breach of contract and the trademark claims.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Harrington, you used all your time, but we asked a lot of questions. You may have 1 minute if you want it.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Judge Hurwitz asked the question, or perhaps it was Judge Holder, or maybe both of you. Why are we required at the pleading stage to elect between A or B, the contract damages or the trademark damages? And I think the better answer to that question is yes, or no, we are not actually required to make that election, because the purpose of that clause in the agreement, it's not to play a game as to what gets pled or not. It is to give a remedy.
Well, it's your option. And the reason I read that language to your opponent is it says, Sleptone made its option. One is accelerate the debts that they bring in action for breach of the agreement. Or C, void the covenant above and institute an action for trademark infringement. Because if the covenant is not voided, then it bars the action for trademark infringement. So isn't your filing of this action for trademark infringement precisely an option to void the covenant?
I think if I may respond to the question, it is an action that voids the covenant not to sue, but it only voids the covenant not to sue. It doesn't require or doesn't let Mr. McCullough off the hook as to the
when you bring this action, Mr. McCullough says, you can't sue me, because I have a covenant. And you say, oh, yes, we can, because we've chosen to sue you rather than pursue the other route.
Right.
I mean, otherwise he can defend your trademark infringement claim fails on its face because he has a covenant.
It fails as to damage, as to acts undertaken prior
before.
To
right. Right. And you are suing
right.
for those.
You are suing, well, I don't think the complaint is clear as to that one.
You are seeking damages for those, right?
You're seeking damages for trademark infringement that occurred. We are definitely seeking it for damages that occurred after.
Because why, if I can use your numbering, why only relates to debts owed to you, which is to say things that occurred beforehand, right?
That's correct.
Okay. You sued him for those.
You sued him for contract breach of contract.
You sued him for debts owed to you. Wholly apart from trademark infringement after the date of settlement, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so when you did that, didn't you necessarily void the covenant, which promised not to sue him for those?
I think the word or there would prevent that from occurring. We can sue him for trademark infringement that occurred after the settlement agreement signed. Even apart from anything, if nothing had happened at all, if there had been no breach of contract except that he continued to
sure, and what I'm having trouble with here, and I know I'm taking you over time, is the language that apparently your client drafted, although I'm not sure the record's clear on that, is void the covenant provided in paragraph 13 above and institute an action for trademark infringement. So it seems to me that in order to institute an action for trademark infringement, you would necessarily have to void the covenant, didn't you?
I think that's... No, I don't think so, because our trademark infringement action could very well have related to acts that occurred after the...
Such action being based upon acts of defendant undertaken both before and after the effective date of this agreement. Do you see something that language, which is kind of strange, says... It is prerequisite to instituting the action for trademark infringement, either before or after, you have to opt to void the covenant.
I think the point is that we elected at the time of the filing of the Second Amendment complaint to do both. And our intention was to give ourselves the option for both remedies at a later stage.
Thank you, counsel. The case just argued is submitted, and we appreciate the arguments from both counsel.